This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Rebecca Raby from Brock University. Rebecca recently co-published a book with Shauna Pomerantz, Smart Girls, Success, School, and the Myth of Post-Feminism with the University of California Press. It's a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here.
I want to start out by saying, like, I have no expertise in any of these fields. I came to your work out of personal interest. I have a daughter entering her teen years, and I became really interested on, you know, what she was going to be facing. And I, before we start, I want to thank Kate Cairns for helping me with this show. And I wanted to disclose that all of the intelligent questions that I ask you actually came from her, and all of the naive questions come from me.
That's great.
All right.
Thank you, Kate.
So let's start off. Tell us about Smart Girls. What's the book about?
So the book began at a really different moment in time that we're in right now, actually, where there were stories abounding about girls thriving in school, and in fact thriving so well in school that they were leaving boys in the dust, and that girls were sort of taking over, that maybe gender inequality is over,
right?
These are some of the stories that were circulating at the time,
right?
And so Shauna approached me actually with this idea to sort of look into girls' experiences in school, because we felt that that story was a really problematic story that didn't describe the full situation of girls' experiences. Huh. And so we talked to a whole lot of girls, and we also talked to some boys about their experiences, like smart girl, like so self-identified smart girls and self-identified smart boys, about their experiences in school, particularly in terms of navigating peer culture. We were interested in the challenges that they experienced, and we certainly found challenges that they experienced, you know, examples of girls dumbing down, for instance, right? Mm. Which, you know, one would think that maybe that doesn't happen anymore, but certainly it was happening in stories that we heard from the girls. And there was even one fella who said, you know, like, I don't mind a girlfriend who's smart, but, you know, she can't be smarter than I am. So these kinds of stories sort of supported we have a whole number of different areas where there are challenges that the girls face, and really, you know, in the longer run, you know, when they were talking about, maybe not so much in the present, but in their expected futures, they were anticipating a world of gender inequality and feeling that they had to overperform and outperform in order to try to have some kind of success later in that sort of gender unequal world. So ultimately, we argue that their success in school isn't so much an example of gender equality as an example of sort of the effects of gender inequality.
So wait, you say that these teenage girls were already aware of a playing field that was going to be slanted against them, and what, they were like trying to get a full head of steam early in life?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. And what age were these subjects?
They ranged from about 14 to 17.
Huh.
And you know, they were across a range of class backgrounds. One critique that our book has had, and is a fair critique, is it wasn't as diverse racially as we had wished. Mm-hmm. But certainly of the girls that we talked to, that was something that we saw.
So what are,
you know, and there was like, there's hope, like this is, I think girls today are at this really experiencing this complicated sort of tension, mm-hmm. right, between this idea that they can do and be anything, and that the world is at their footsteps and girl power reigns, and then at the same time, like exactly at the same time, there's that know that they are in a world that has gender inequality, that it particularly sort of unfolds as you start to have a family, as you start to sort of compete in the sort of larger paid world, that, but also they see it amongst, you know, in terms of like things like sexual harassment and those kinds of things. And so they have these contradictory pulls on them in terms of how to think about their lives that are challenging to navigate.
It sounds like these girls, you know, that I often hear of, that, you know, that pressure to be all things to all people, like super successful mother, super successful in your career, super successful in your marriage, you know, the trying to make, yeah, like that pressure. I'm hearing that like girls are feeling that almost immediately, and it's like a weight that they're carrying on their shoulders.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think, actually, I think we have to be super careful not to generalize all girls, right? Of course, intersectionality is significant here. But certainly from our research, but also research that I've read of other people, it's suggesting that there's this competitive, individualized climate, and this feeling of a need to be perfect at everything and to be really good at everything and to have the most successful possible sort of portfolio, right, for going on into college, going on into the workplace, and that you have to sort of do everything that you can to be successful. And it's a really, really hard place to be, right, in that kind of perfectionist location. And I think that we can link it to, you know, issues of growing anxiety. And then it also raises the bar. It raises the bar so high in ways that many girls will never be able to meet that bar, right, because of issues of inequality. You know, like, even like, do they have the resources to be able to sort of compete with these girls who are able to sort of seemingly excel at everything?
I have a question. Were for the smart girls in your study, were there peer relationships with other girls? Were they edifying, or were they problematic, or, you know, what was the balance?
Right. Like, were they mean girls?
Well, yeah, you know, this is the dad in me talking, right? Where I'm like worried about 100 things.
Right. No kidding. You know, we actually, the way we set up our research is that we interviewed people either on their own or in pairs.
Okay.
And a number of them we interviewed in pairs. Mm-hmm. And we're struck by the friendships that girls talk to us about, mm-hmm. The support that they experienced from their friends.
Right.
And sometimes from boyfriends.
Okay.
And, you know, I know there's lots of other people who have done research around girls cutting each other down, but in our research, I would say that we found more so that girls were holding each other up.
There's at least among the successful girls, like, yeah, the girls, well, who think that this one.
Yeah, well, this was one of the, yes, absolutely, people who self-declared that they are smart girls. And then we also found that school culture seemed to make quite a bit of difference in terms of these girls' experiences, right?
Oh, how so?
Well, if you had a school culture that seemed to support and foster academic excellence, mm-hmm. and also a school culture that seemed to have some, you know, flexibility around ideas around masculinity and femininity,
uh-huh.
Schools that had that were large enough to sort of have a diverse population base,
mm-hmm.
you know, schools that had programs like, you know, coding for girls, right? Or like a reach for the top team that was sort of valued just as much as the football team, right?
Oh, wait,
those
just
context helped.
Reach for the top is
Yeah,
reach for the top is like a quiz. It's like the quiz team, the trivia quiz, yes, competition. By the way, Timmins High, Northeastern Ontario, competitive team alumnus I am. Very proud.
It's all been downhill from there, right?
that's where I peaked out when we went to Sudbury and lost.
So you're like a guy in a Springsteen song talking about his high school football.
Yeah, except it was reach for the top. But in any case,
yeah, you go. But that's, well, but
so
that's
that like
part
what
of the
we
point.
Call academic decathlon here.
I think it might be.
Yeah.
Question though, but like, okay, so let's say, oh, it's a, Oh, I'm sorry. Did I cut you off?
I just wanted to say one more thing about that. Yeah, no. And that about the school culture, to link it to the question about peers, right?
Yeah.
Is that, so in that kind of school climate, right, you have a popular reach for the top team, then you're hanging out with other kids who are, you know, excelling academically like you are, and, you know, you're feeling more like it's okay than in another kind of setting where it might be that the sort of peer culture is less welcoming. And we certainly talked to girls where the peer culture was a lot less welcoming.
Did peer culture, for any of your subjects, did peer culture end up being a big hurdle to succeeding, where people withdrew from school or felt like they were below their potential?
Because of peer culture?
Because of peer culture. Or is it that when you run into smart girls in general, like they seem to be in a good place, socially, I mean?
Right. I think that really, truly, it seemed to depend so much on the girl, right?
Interesting.
And the boys we talked to as well, right? It depended on the school they were at, the kinds of friendship circles they were in, the resources that their family had, their own personal resources. Some of them were really thriving in ways that were very exciting to us. Mm-hmm. And some of them were having a harder time.
So as a parent, let's say you want,
what do you do?
Yeah. Like, what do you push your school to do? Like, what types of programs are you pushing at your school? What types of policies are you pushing at your school? What should I be asking the principal for?
Right. Well, I would be asking the principal for recognition, like school-based celebration and recognition of diverse ways of being, right? Huh. Of the arts, of academics, of sports, and not, you know, being all about the one thing, right? So there needs to be space in that school for different students to thrive, and for there to be a valuing and a recognition of diverse ways that students can be. And I do feel, and this is something that I've, you know, some other researchers have been poking at a little bit, that settings where there is more flexibility around gender can lead to more possibilities for students to feel comfortable being smart. And what that's for boys as well as girls.
What do you mean by flexibility with gender?
Okay. So one of the things that we found is that sometimes the girls who felt uncomfortable, so they see themselves as smart, but they felt uncomfortable doing things like putting up their hand in class or having other people know their grades, that they were uncomfortable because they were worried that that would be seen as not, that you're not being like appropriately girl-like, right? Because to be appropriately girl-like, you need to be kind of quiet and you need to be not so smart and not so in your face, right? Huh. And to be, you know, like Matt, for the boys, right, that they kind of need to be seen as being, you know, strong and tough, and they could be seen as smart, but they don't want to be seen as studying, right? Mm. So, and these are linked to, I think anyway, that they're linked to, you know, ideas around hegemonic masculinity and ideas around certain kinds of femininity. And so that if we open that up, right, it's okay to be a smart boy. It's okay to be a smart girl. It's okay to be studying as a boy. It's okay to be a girl who's playing sports, right? That it that and the sort of recognition in a school of valuing that kind of diversity, I think allows different students to be able to thrive in their own ways, right? Uh-huh. You know, there's a really cool picture that I don't even know where it's from, but it's this picture of this kid, this boy who's in his football uniform on the football field, and he's playing the violin, and it says something like, you know, I can't even remember what it says, but it's about sort of recognizing that, you know, that you can be both a football player and a violin player. And I really like that picture.
Amazing. Gabe, before I get to more questions, you want to jump in?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. That's fine. Okay. So, all right. Okay. So we'll move into the Kate Cairns intelligent questions, the section of the interview then. So the first question along these lines, as we pull back, is, has the landscape of girlhood changed since you started this research? I guess this was an outgrowth of this book was an outgrowth of your earlier paper, right? In gender and education, or?
Yeah, that was a pilot study, the one that I sent to you.
Yeah.
And I sent it to you because it sort of, a lot of the arguments that we developed later are evident in that paper, It's just sort of more a small bite than a big bite.
Sure.
The book would be.
But I mean, it's been a few years. Have things changed since you started doing this?
Yeah. When we were writing this book, it was before the last American presidential election.
Right.
And I think that there was a sense, like one of the things that we talk in the book is post-feminism, right?
What is that?
Post-feminism is the idea that feminism has done its job, mm-hmm. right? That there was gender inequality and then feminism came along and now gender inequality is addressed. Mm. And that we're in this sort of post-feminist age. And people have talked about like a post-race age as well, right? Mm. It's all linked to this sort of neoliberal idea that, you know, inequalities have somehow faded away and that we're all sort of individually equal in our competition with each other.
Right.
So, so this idea of post-feminism, I think, was more convincing mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. before the last presidential election in the United States, right?
When it looked Hillary had a 90%
chance of winning. Yeah, that there might be a woman president, that, you know, it seemed like, you know, that that really women were making gains and it was sort of like an exciting time. And then since then, there's been a shift, right? And we've seen the rise of this, of the Me Too movement, which on the one hand can be seen as a movement of power, but it's also a movement that's about really drawing attention to significant ongoing gender inequality and especially how, like, some of the responses to that, to, you know, women's disclosure of having been harassed or assaulted or whatever the case might be, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that has shifted. I also think that there was this period of time, certainly in my own work, where there was excitement about the possibilities of the online world for young people. And I still think that there are exciting possibilities of the online world for young people where they can share their voices and that they can speak their mind and it's pretty accessible. But we've also seen this huge rise of hate in response to people's online presence or in response to speaking out. And a lot of that has been misogynist, right? Like, it's often more likely to be directed towards women in really hard ways that makes it more difficult to speak up. And so I think that actually, you know, our book, there's some parts of the book that's kind of depressing, right? That there's these sort of ongoing inequalities that these girls struggle with in their everyday teenage lives. And I think that maybe if we did the study now, we would find that to still be the case. And maybe a little bit more recognition of the ongoing inequalities that they're experiencing. Like, maybe there's more of a language. Like, this is one of the things we talk about in the book, is that a lot of the girls, they could identify inequalities, but they didn't seem to have a language to talk about them. And I'm wondering if now they might have more of a language to talk about them.
Yeah, it's like a double-edged sword, isn't it? It's like, mm-hmm. It's nice to be sort of oblivious to problems. But on the other hand, I guess when you recognize them and you develop the verbal equipment to engage them, at least you're confronting problems that still exist.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and then what about this whole line of research, girls' identity and education? What do you feel this line of work has to contribute to broader sociology debates? Like, are we getting beyond adding girls in, to quote Kate, or are there deeper contributions to be made?
So one of the things that I think has been valuable in childhood studies and in girlhood studies is how we've been thinking about and maybe challenging certain kinds of, in some areas of girl studies and childhood studies, we've been challenging ways of talking about agency that are really based on humanism, right? So on the one hand, so in child studies, first, there was sort of this wave of interest in recognizing children as agents in a humanist type way, right? Mm-hmm. And recognizing girls as agents and recognizing them as sort of able to make change in the world that they're in, as having a valuable voice, as being meaningful participants, mm-hmm. Which was really different than how children and especially girls were portrayed more sort of historically in sociology and psychology. Mm-hmm. And more recently, though, some people have been, you know, there's been some questioning of that kind of orientation to agency and, you know, recognizing how, you know, that the subject is always sort of embedded in, you know, these discursive contexts. And more recently, you know, we've been both Sean and I've been drawn to sort of a more, you know, post-humanist thinking that sort of recognizing sort of agency as this sort of interactive moment that, where it's sort of not just always about sort of what humans are doing, right? Mm-hmm. But humans in relation to all sorts of other things. And so I feel that I'm excited by those kinds of possibilities. And we, you know, we kind of, you know, our book was written with the hopes that your everyday person could read it. So we don't get into a lot of detail about theory except in the footnotes. Mm-hmm. But we do, in that book, we sort of come from maybe more of a post-structuralist perspective. And I've been, excited by sort of how our thinking along with a whole lot of other people's thinking is raising questions about this idea of agency. And I think that, and it's cool, I think that some of that's coming from, both childhood studies and girlhood studies.
You know, when I was looking at your work, I really liked that about your whole take on stuff. I loved how you don't infantilize young women. And, you know, everything that I've heard or read from you, I'm like, wow, what extraordinary young women or what smart young women. And I know you've done work on like children's rights and treating, you know, respecting children. And it's a really interesting take. You know, even if you parent a child, sometimes you see them as children and you underplay the, you know, it's natural to, or it's easy to underplay the degree to which, you know, they're smart and aware and critical and, you know, deep in thought. So I like that about your work a lot.
Oh, thank you.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.